Emma, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
What always interests me about your writing life is, I guess like me, you seem to be a writer who packs an awful lot in. You teach and you've got a very active blog, and but you also are a productive writer, and I'm sure that people will be really interested to hear how you manage that and how you balance the various aspects of your writing life. Do you have a kind of plan for that, or does it just sort of, yeah, I mean, tell me, how do you do it? How do you do it all?
I think it does help that I've got quite big children who are relatively self-propelling. But I think, I mean, the biggest difference, I used to really struggle in the sense that, you know, the foundation of it all is the novel that I'm writing at the moment. You know, I'm absolutely a novelist, you know, much more than I'm anything else. But the problem with novels is that they're the important but not urgent thing, I think, and it's, sorry, it's too easy to sort of, you have to set it aside because there's this to do, there's money to earn, there's you know, there's the plumber coming, there's an awful risk that it's always the thing that you put aside because something else is more urgent, mm-hmm. even if it's not more important. Mm-hmm. And that was particularly true. I found once I started teaching regularly for the Open University, which is the first thing I'd had where, you know, there are times I have to do things whether I want to or not. But the thing that made the biggest difference actually was I suddenly had a brainwave, and I don't know why it only took me 10 years to work this one out, but that I have an absolute rule that I don't work on anyone else's writing except my own at the weekends, come what may. Because after all, if I had a separate office, that would be true. Once I've gone home, I've gone home. Anything that I haven't dealt with by Friday night can stew until Monday morning. And that's partly, that does mean that the hours get put in. You know, it means that there's seat of pants to seat of chair does happen. Mm-hmm. But the knock-on effect that I hadn't, well, I thought, well, that's okay, that's 2 days writing that I know will happen. But what was interesting and what I sort of hadn't quite expected was that what it meant was I was much less furious with all the other stuff in the week because I knew that the writing time was safe, mm-hmm. that it would happen, mm-hmm. that I wasn't constantly saying, oh, but I want to get back to the book. And what that had an interesting result, that it made me resist the rest of everything less furiously. Mm. It meant that instead of on Thursday thinking, oh, God, I really ought to do this marking, or I really ought to do this, you know, whatever, and sort of doing it and sort of not because I was resenting it. I thought, well, if I don't do it now, it's not going to get done till Monday, so I better do it. So I did it, and then it was done, if that makes any sense. And that was out of the way, and then I could focus on the writing. So it actually, oddly, made me much more productive and organized with everything else.
So does that mean that you work for a set amount of time at the weekends, or you just make sure you write both days?
I write both days. I don't do anything else except sort of leisure. You know, if I want to put my feet up and watch something on telly, then I do. But basically, I don't. And you know, if I've got something else going on, if I'm going to see friends or if friends are coming around, then so be it. But what I don't let any other work impinge.
Yes.
Any emails I haven't answered, because that is the risk about working at home, is that you could always be working. Mm. The flip side of the fact that you could never be working and nobody would notice.
Yes. Do you also find time to work on the novel in the week, depending on what's going on?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing, particularly with my Open University teaching, is it's quite feast or famine in the sense that it's almost all online, so I don't have to leave home. On a week when I'm not running a tutorial in the forum and I'm not marking anyone's work, it's really not very busy. The flip side of that is when everybody's assignments descend in my lap, they've got to be turned around very thoroughly, and the marking is huge because it's the main form of the teaching is what I write on the edges of their stories. So you have to be very comprehensive. So that takes ages. But you do know it's coming. You know, I know when those fortnights are going to be in my diary, and there they are, and so I know that's happening. So I do, every week has a different shape, depending. And yes, on a really good week, I'll have to check in, you know, I'll check into my OU email every day. I'll check into the forum a couple of times a week. The students know when to expect me to be there. And then I might actually have, you know, anything between 1 and 3 or 4 days on the novel.
Mm, fantastic.
But quite often not, you know, it does just depend. Mm. But the key really is to see, is to sort of know and to keep things clear. If I can see I've got a clear day that I will be able to spend on the novel, then I do try quite hard not to let that get nibbled at by, you know, whatever. Mm. Online grocery deliveries are your friend.
I mean, that's the sort of, you know, we've gone in on the practical side of your work, but, you know, if we shift over to inspiration for a moment, your first novel, Mathematics of Love, as I've said, you know, did very well. It was short and long-listed for various literary prizes. And I wonder how that novel came about and where the impulse for that novel came. Did it begin with an idea, or did it come fully formed into your head? It's that question. How did it? Yes. Do you remember the germ?
I do, actually, and it's a classic example of what my agent said to me when I told the story. Ah, yes, the character who won't go away, because in fact, what it was a good 4 or 5 years before I did the first ever writing course I ever did, which was a one on Skiros, you know, which is the sort of alternative holiday center, and it was just a little exercise that she gave us. She said, I want you to spend 20 minutes writing a story called Watch. She actually took her watch off and put it on the table, so for a bit I thought it was going to be about that, but then I realized in the sort of Mediterranean landscape that it was actually going to be about a soldier watching a soldier in an occupying force watching a native girl, a girl bathing in the river, and it wasn't one of the world's great stories, but it had something about it, and and then he kind of hung around in my head, and then later on in another novel I was working on, which never saw the light of day, under the bed to this day, I wanted to explore something which I think is very interesting for a writer to explore, which is this business of how you get the reader to understand things that the narrator isn't quite saying, or isn't saying, or doesn't understand themselves. They're transmitting it, but they don't get it. Mm-hmm. And of course, an obvious way that you can, you know, sort of a coded way of doing that is to write letters. So I had this idea of a soldier who, and he was clearly in Spain. I just sort of knew the way you do. And he was a soldier of Wellington's army. And so I thought about how as a writer you can convey the awful, the post-traumatic side of it, if you like, through someone who isn't talking about that, because soldiers don't. And so I imagined as an element in this novel, which is mostly about something completely different, I imagined him having struck up a conversation with someone, sort of telling bits of his life story in a way that would seem to make good stories, but actually the reader reads between the lines about what's really going on. And that novel, as I say, didn't work. But he, of course, once you've thought about both what he does say and about what he doesn't say, you know an awful lot about him. And so when I finally, having had lots of work rejected, signed up to do the Masters, the MPhil at Glamorgan, I knew that he needed a novel. You know, there was scope for him to be a whole large part of a novel, both his letters and his narration. Mm-hmm. And he ended up being half of The Mathematics of Love, and the other half was set in 1976. Mm. So he got half a novel to himself.
Yes, absolutely, and very good novel as well, I must say.
Thank you.
I'm really interested in the fact that you do use dual narrative in both of your novels. There's a dual narrative there. Is that something that particularly interests you? How did that other narrative come about, and that you decided to work on two time levels?
Yes, well, I mean, it does interest me. I think it's difficult to do well, and I've had rejections by agents who don't like dual narrative full stop. Mm. Some people just don't get it. And I think it is hard to do well. I did it for Mathematics of Love largely because, well, partly I very, very much wanted to write about photography, which is the only other sort of creative thing I do sort of reasonably seriously apart from writing. But My Lovely Soldier happened before photography was invented. But I wanted to write about voyeurism and all that sort of stuff, and things like what's happening between two people when one of them is making a portrait of the other. You know, I think that's absolutely fascinating. What are the tensions and dynamics going on there, and so on. And I wanted to write about war, and it was a way of like, you know, setting up a very strong light on one side of the face. And then when you put in what the photographers call a fill light on the other side, and you suddenly see another aspect of it. And so I sort of wanted to do that. And I think I didn't, it seemed to me so obviously what I wanted to do and the way to do what I wanted to do, that I hadn't quite realized it was sort of an issue until I had a rejection by an agent. And I have to say, not as good an agent as my present agent, so that's quite gratifying. And so I am very drawn to it. Secret Alchemy was more complicated still because it's got two narrators in the medieval bit and a modern narrator. And again, the issue always is how you tie the two together. You know, that basically the reader is starting out by wondering why these two separate stories are in the same novel. And you have to work really hard to make them feel that both the stories are the better for being up with, you know, all embroiled with the other one, if you see what I mean.
Yes. And then, of course, there's the sort of tangible links as well as the
thematic links. There has to be the tangible links. When I first wrote Mathematics of Love, Stephen wrote his letters in the early, you know, the earlier strand, but because I couldn't bear to do the kind of trunk in the attic thing with letters being found. And so I didn't, and so there were a lot of connections, but they were all sort of thematic and about ideas and stuff like that. And the MPhil were happy with that. You know, my tutor and my, you know, my fellows on the MPhil were quite happy to go with that. But as soon as I started sending it out to the trade, I got feedback basically saying, we need there to be a plot connection. There has to be a connection at the level of story.
Yeah.
It's not enough for them just to sort of rub up next to each other. So I then I got quite stuck on that because I had very clearly decided I didn't want to make her find a trunk in the attic. And it was when I suddenly thought, all right, she's going to have to get sight of these, you know, my modern, 1976 Anna is going to have to see these letters. And it's not enough just that she reads them. What she reads has got to change who she is and what she does. I mean, it's got to be a level of, you know, it's got to be a plot connection at that level. It's got to affect the story in the later bit. And then I suddenly realized that actually, of course, they were ancient letters from an archive. They wouldn't just have, no one would have handed them over. And I suddenly realized they would have been photocopied. And because the whole book's about photography, and it was very much, you know, remember the old Xeroxes, you know, sort of shiny paper and everything. And I suddenly realized that that's another kind of photography. And as soon as the letters had I could have a kind of thematic connection with everything else that's going on. The business of light changing the chemicals in the photographic material, you know, and in a way that light's locked into the chemistry of the paper after that. And that light came from before. And that I still find that rather extraordinary, to think the light that's locked into the black silver, you know, the black and silver of a photographic emulsion is light that came from 1820.
Wow.
Which is why I keep going back to photography. and once I'd both worked out what the plot connection would be, and I'd worked out what it could be about Anna's story that was changed by her reading these letters and understanding them, and sort of physically how I could make them present in the new thing in an interesting way, not just in a cliched way. Then I thought, okay, yeah, fine, all right. And
I think
did
what's interesting is the way you describe it. You know, you are describing that sort of very organic method and way in which something grows. And I wondered what you felt the impact of doing the MPhil followed by the PhD had on your writing, and whether that's something that you would recommend to others.
Let me think. It was certainly, the MPhil was entirely beneficial. I mean, I'd only done one very short course, the one on Skiros, before that. The MPhil is rather unusual because most masters are taught and you do various sort of modules and courses and this and that and the other. And I think they can be immensely valuable, and not just for the form that you want to do. I think it's very good for prose writers to learn to deal with poetry, for instance, because it's so good for your sort of writing muscles, that kind of thing. But the MPhil at Glamorgan it's more like a PhD in the sense that you sit down and you write a full body of work, a novel, a collection of short fiction, a collection of poetry. And you submit it like you do a PhD, and you get vivid on it. And so it's very well suited to someone like, as at the stage I was then. I knew how to write a novel. I had five under the bed, six under the bed. I was maybe wrong to think I don't want to do poetry, as it were. In fact, I think I probably was. But what I really needed was just a bit more support than doing it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And to some workshopping, which was useful. The input from my tutor was extremely useful. It gave a sort of shape to it, to the work on it. And it was that novel, admittedly with other feedback, that then got me an agent and got me the deal with Headline.
Yeah.
The PhD was slightly complicated, partly because, again, it's a novel, that's 70% of it, and then you do a sort of big critical commentary, which is 30% of it. That was more complicated because the novel was A Secret Alchemy, which was under contract to Headline.
Mm.
So I had an editor breathing down my neck and an agent breathing down my neck, and to have a supervisor breathing down my neck as well was...
Yeah.
So actually my supervisor was wonderful because she basically stood back from it. She said afterwards, I would have been much more hands-on if you hadn't been writing it to contract.
I suppose Linda Buckley Archer would have been going through a very similar thing.
She was,
at the same time as you, because she was very much, I know she was at the same university as you doing it.
Yeah, she was. No, that's how we met, actually. And she was juggling even more because she was juggling, you know, the whole of the Tarman trilogy, whereas I was just juggling the one damn novel. Felt like a trilogy on occasions, but it wasn't. I think it can be very rewarding, and it certainly was. It was the reason I did it largely. Well, I thought about it when I was having the Mathematics of Love rejected by various agents, and was thinking, okay, what do I do next if this doesn't sell?
Mm.
And sort of nosed around. I lived down the road from Goldsmiths, which helped. And then in fact. Was taken on by my agent, and who sold the novel quite fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, okay, well, do I do this or not?
Mm.
And then I thought, actually, I knew that I wanted to get into teaching, and I don't have a teaching background, so it wasn't, you know, I couldn't just say, well, I'm really an English teacher, but now I'm teaching creative writing. You know, I had to prove that I knew my stuff. And so I thought, well, that will be a way of acquiring a piece of paper, if you like, but also expanding what I was doing. It's not often you have to write 30,000 words about how you set about writing a novel, which is what the PhD demands. So, my goodness, you have to think about it.
I was going to say, what was your sort of specific subject? Because presumably the thesis has to have an emphasis or a title. How did that relate to
what you're doing? The University of London regs are quite tightly drawn. I've discovered since then that a lot of PhDs are much more open-ended, and you just sort of do a critical paper about some aspect of, you know, literature which hitches up with what you were doing. But with London, it has to be a critical commentary, basically, on what you were trying to do, what you did, what happened.
Mm.
You have to draw in the sort of, I can't remember what their phrase is, critical, theoretical, and historical arguments in your genre, you know, and all that sort of stuff. You have to show that you're up to speed with your genre and with the history of it and with what the issues are in it and so on. And so what I did was I took some of the two or three of the sort of major aspects of Secret Alchemy, one of which was the business of using real historical characters in historical fiction, one of which was parallel narrative, and a couple of other things like language, you know, how do you handle language in historical fiction and that sort of stuff. And I just built the chapters around that, and I sort of talked about what I'd done and the problems I'd faced and how I'd solved them. And then I looked at what, you know, how other writers, both sort of past and present, had also done it. So I was looking at people like William Golding and early Peter Ackroyd, Rose Tremaine, those sorts of writers, things about the ethics of using real historical characters, whether you can and whether you can't, and, you know, so on. And it ended up, I mean, it was a real fight, I must admit, partly because Mathematics of Love was being published, and that was all much more distracting than I thought it would be. But in the end, I am really glad I did it, and I find it does, because I had to think about it really properly and get it into coherent shape and get it down on paper and be examined on it. You know, it does make you think much harder and more clearly and more thoroughly than when you're just sitting there having a nice old natter with a friend.
How has it affected you since, do you think, in your writing? Has it, does it feel very freeing not to be working within that structure anymore? Do you find some of those learnings are just kind of instinctive
now? I mean, to be honest, I don't think doing it either for the MPhil or for the PhD. I didn't work creatively any other way other than I did anyway. Mm. I think partly the MPhil is, again, it's an odd beast. It's much more like a PhD in the sense that you, across the 2 years of the MPhil, you only have 8 workshops. And so a lot of the time you're on your own. And every now and then you give the current bit a spit and a polish and submit it to the workshop, as it were. So you're not, it's not, it avoids writing by committee, which I think is a risk of the academic side of things, that, mm-hmm. you know, you bring the new bit in every week and everybody has a go at it and then you go home, you know, and so on. And you don't have that so much because you're not getting that very, very frequent feedback. So it, in a way, that didn't. I don't think it made an awful lot of difference. But there's no denying having the feedback made them both be better books than they would have been otherwise.
Yeah. What about research, Emma? It's I know it's a sort of it's a huge area, but do you tend, when you have an instinct towards writing about a particular area of history, do you feel that you have to know it thoroughly before you begin?
I wouldn't say know it thoroughly. I think you have to know it. But I've tended to write about periods that I was interested in anyway, actually. Mm. I think I know people who research, you know, who research as they go. I never write worse than when I've got the textbook in my other hand. Mm. Partly because it often, you know, it gets terribly info dumpy because all this stuff is delicious. You know, we write historical fiction because we love historical fact. Mm. And the risk is that it does go in terribly undigestedly. So what I tend to do is read a lot before, but quite freely. I mean, the most I do in the way of notes would be to have a pencil and scribble in the margin,
right,
of the book, you know, just a heading so that I can furl through the book and find something that I knew at the time was useful and interesting, you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm always, Rose Tremain has the most wonderful thing she says about how when you research, you have to, what's the phrase, the stuff you've researched is imaginatively inert.
Mm.
It's data.
Mm.
And what you have to do is, she says, you have to let it rise into the magical gift-conjuring part of your brain. So you have to leave it behind as data.
Yeah.
And I think that's tremendously important. And I think, I mean, it's why I don't make notes a lot of the time, in a way, is because I need to forget it. It needs to, the historical fact has to have no different status in my imagination from facts that I know anyway, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
From, you know, I mean, when you write about your own world, or, you know, approximately your own world, you don't have to go out and solemnly write down the names of all the shops in your high street. You just write it, you know, and it's your imagination that decides whether they have the row outside the supermarket or the wool shop.
Mm-hmm.
And equally, in a way, what I'm trying to do is sort of fill my brain up with whatever it feels like holding on to. and then trusting that when I decide that my 15th century characters are going to have a row, the imagination will decide whether they have it on a row in the middle of Paul's Walk or out on the river, mm-hmm. or whatever. I mean, I might then at some point reach a long arm for a book and just check how long it might have taken for them to have that row along Paul's Walk. But, you know, frankly, how many readers are going to call me if I've got it wrong?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think it's enormously important to leave the research behind, because otherwise it's just data handling.
Mm.
You know, all you're doing is writing sort of docudrama. And you know how stilted your average kind of police reconstruction on the telly is, or indeed, you know, the very kind of educational dramatizations of bits of history. And I mean, they're admirable as education, but they're useless as drama.
Mm.
And I think it's tremendously important to do that. But of course, you do then need an alarm for when you are getting something wrong enough that readers are going to trip up on it. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I tend to read around enormously beforehand and then write the whole novel and emerge with a large sheet of things I need to check.
Afterwards.
And then, yeah, you may go away and find something, you know, that means you've got to have a redo, because you really, really have totally mistaken how long it would take to sail from London to Bilbao. You know, you might have to have a rethink. I mean, you could always fudge some things that you either can't find out or whatever, but the more you fudge, the sort of greyer and flatter it all becomes.
Mm.
The less it really comes vividly and specifically off the page, which is what you're trying to do.
And when you are in the process of writing, do you find that, I mean, I said, it's the big question. How does one do that? Do you find that you are really transported to the place in your imagination where your characters are? When you're writing, do you actually feel as if you're living it, or do you feel at some distance from the act, from the event?
I think it depends. I think one can. I think to some degree, yes, I am in there. I mean, it's not necessarily very magic. Sometimes it is completely magical, but more often it's just about focus. I'm there, you know, in the same way that if I'm writing, I'm maybe writing, you know, I'm in the middle of a blog post at the moment. You know, my brain is all in that blog post. If you see what I mean. I'm not much more or less aware of, you know, what's going on in the street or whatever when I'm writing fiction. It's just a more interesting place to be.
Yeah.
But I think for me it is about concentration. Having said that, there's no denying that if I go downstairs to make a cup of coffee and somebody says something to me, I may not make a lot of sense for a while.
I'm just thinking about your blog posts, actually, Emma, because, you know, you've got a wonderful blog, and you know, which I always think your posts are so intelligently written about the craft of writing. I think if anybody listening here hasn't been to the blog, then do check it out. It's This Itch of Writing. But what I was thinking, Emma, is how do you go about thinking about and writing the blog post? Do you have a regular posting schedule? Do you draft and redraft your blogs? Is there no specific way in which you approach that? Because obviously having a blog is more and more seen to be something that a writer should do. Publishers are looking for authors with platforms. You know, what's your approach to it?
Well, I mean, I tend to, I don't blog as often as I should, partly because they tend to be fairly substantial. And I do try and blog once a week and don't always succeed. And it's never going to be, you know, a blog with a gazillion followers, because it's not that kind of thing. It's quite specialist. I usually what happens is that I either have an idea, or very often something comes up on a forum, or I find myself saying, you know, writing something fairly at length to a student about some question they've asked, and then I will literally just cut and paste and stick it in as a draft blog post while I'm there. And then when the blog starts looking a bit hungry and gets a wistful look in its eyes of something that would like a bit of attention, please, I just go along and have a look at all those drafts and see which one seems to me something that I'm thinking about or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, for the voice, it is very much the same voice that I would talk to my students in, I think. Mm-hmm. It is one of the things that was interesting about doing the PhD was having, you know, that was a completely different voice in a way. This is meant not to be terribly formal. On the other hand, the things I'm talking about are things that need fairly exactly expressing sometimes, you know, so it's not, it has to be, I nearly said complexly, but I hope it doesn't come across as complex, but you know, I am explaining something or working something out, you know, there's a shape to what I'm saying, and therefore, you know, the logical connections need to be there, and the examples need to be there, and all the rest of it, but I hope they're not a difficult read.
No, not at all.
I don't
I think
want
it's
them
just
to be.
That they are very informative. I think it's the fact that you do clearly put some effort into it. You know, and I know many blog writers sort of think that actually you can just dash a blog post out. So I think it's admirable that your blog posts are substantial.
Well, they are. They are. I mean, it's. I think there is a different kind of blog, which is, I think, is. It's harder to make successful now than it used to be when there were fewer about. Just of someone who's just got a really nice and interesting take on life, you know, or witty take on life or something, and it's just fun, and one drops past that blog to see what they're rabbiting on about today, you know, rather as you might with a columnist in the paper or something. But there's so much noise out there now, that's harder to get an audience for, I think. And with the other way that blogs work is if it's about something that there are people out there who are interested in. And that, you know, that is the way, I think, if you're thinking about blogging with a view to being able to say to agents and editors, hey, you know, I know my way around the social media and the blogs and so on, and I have a following, then I think that's the thing to do, is to look for something which you positively enjoy thinking. I mean, that's the thing with my blog, is I like doing it, you know, I like thinking it out. Lots of things that cropped up, first of all, as a question in a forum or a class, I then thought, I'm going to go over to the blog and have a think about that, because I don't, you know, I know what I think, but I don't know why I think it or whether it applies to anyone else, you know, or someone talks about how they write a novel, which is so different from how I write a novel, you know, whatever. And so it's, you know, often it's me actually thinking aloud for myself as well, and I think that comes across. And of course, it informs my teaching enormously, because once I've thought something out properly, then I'm in a much better place to transmit it to, you know, to transmit it onwards to students and things.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, it is a bit neglected. I am brewing. I'm not sure I'm going to do it, but I'm seriously brewing a book on creative writing. And if I do, then I will, you know, roll my sleeves up and sort the blog out, and I'll probably bring it up a bit more to speed. You know, next time I've got a novel coming out, you know, then it'll get a bit more chatter about the sort of writing life and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I'm not averse to talking about my, you know, what's going on in my professional life, but I'm not really interested in self-promotion at that level. And anyway, it's very boring reading a blog that said I had a, you know, you never, I did this event and that event and it was lovely. Well, yes, yeah, okay, it was. So what? As it were. Yeah, well, my basic rule is I don't talk about things unless I've got something to say about them that's actually interesting of itself, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not interested in the what I had for breakfast blog.
What I'm going to do, Emma, now, is I'm going to bring in a few other people to come on for the conversation. We've got Louise, Rowena and Catherine here, and I wondered if any of you would like to ask Emma a question, if anybody wants to jump in.
It's Louise here. I'm maybe going off a bit of a tangent here. I taught my first creative writing evening class just until Easter. And the thing I found really difficult was what you were mentioning, the marking, actually grading students pieces of creative work.
Yeah.
Within your own OU teaching, did you find the marking difficult?
Well, I was lucky with the OU because there's a very clear marking structure, as there has to be, because they've got, you know, 250 tutors who all should be marking as closely as possible to the same standard. It is difficult. I was astonished how successfully the descriptors that the OU produced were at managing to sort of pin down, you know, what makes a piece of work better or less good. You are aware that it can't be entirely objective, but usually there's kind of how well does it work overall, isn't there? And then there's kind of technical stuff. Are they using creative writing techniques well? Have they got interesting ideas? And of course, you can get someone who's technically extremely competent whose work is basically rather dull. And equally, I'm sure you can have the mad maverick who's a bit all over the place, but there's something in the middle of that is just fantastic. I think giving them grades is really hard, and I would find it very difficult. If I would find it easier now because I'd start from what the OU expects of me, but it is difficult. I think you can always just say this is working because this isn't working because. I think what's much more useful for them in a way is for you to unpick, you know, what it is that isn't working, because that's how they'll learn. I mean, for instance, in the blog post I'm going to put up in a minute, I find myself talking about how I'll often find myself saying, normally I say that these comma splices shouldn't be here because comma splices shouldn't be there, but your character here is very, you know, fast and incoherent, and I think therefore it works rather well.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. And that takes an awful lot longer than either crossing all the comma splices out or just, you know, moving on, ignoring them because in a sense they don't need correcting because they're right. But on the other hand, that's something where they're using, either by mistake or on purpose, they're using something creatively, and that's what you're trying to... That's what you're trying to bring out, I think.
But it's
hard. It's not easy to do.
Oh, thanks very much.
As she says, not very helpfully, really.
No, that was great. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Anyone else?
Catherine or Arena, yes.
Catherine.
Any more questions?
Okay, it's Rowena here then.
Hi.
I was just really interested in the fact that you'd sold your novel, but you carried on doing your PhD. so that it was clearly kind of you had two objectives. You not only to write a publishable novel that would sell, but also to actually get an academic qualification. And I found that it's not really a question, but I did find that fascinating to hear you discuss that.
Yes, I mean, it was partly, I did know that writing the next novel was going to be a challenge, partly because it was a very challenging project, but also because I sort of knew, though I didn't really know, if you know what I mean, that being published changes your whole relationship to your writing. I'm sure that Jackie would agree, and anyone else who's published it. You know, whether your first novel comes out to bookerfuls of praise or it, you know, disappears without trace, it is different once it's out there. And I sort of intuitively knew that, and I thought, well, if I'm doing the PhD, A, I'll have a supervisor. Just at the very least, and bless her, this is exactly what she did, sort of saying, so when will we be seeing the next chapter? You know, there's a lot to be said for just having someone. It's the sort of Weight Watchers principle, you know, you are going to have to be there next week.
Yeah.
I knew that, you know, the chances of my ever earning a full and comfortable living purely from writing the fiction that I am moved to write are more or less nil, and I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what it's like, unless you are very commercial and you write at least a novel a year.
Yeah.
So I always knew I needed another string to my bow, and I'm not a natural journalist or reviewer, which is the other sort of obvious thing to do, and I didn't have a kind of other career in waiting. I mean, lots of people happily go on being lawyers or doctors or, you know, or whatever, but I didn't really. I'd had lots of bits of jobs and so on, so I didn't have another obvious career to fill up the gap with. And I also knew, which is the sort of thing they don't tell you, that on the whole, if you looked across everybody getting their first novel published and their second novel published, more of them would have disappeared without trace after three or four novels than would still be there. That's the economics of it.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Bingham's book, Getting Published, is very good on this stuff. I didn't really understand the whys and wherefores of it till I read that. and so I basically knew that, you know, that in a sense, to get your first contract feels fantastic and amazing, and it's been the thing you've been trying for so hard, for so long. And actually, it's only, you know, it is only getting your novel published. You know, it's not the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah.
And so I reckon that actually, you know, it was no bad thing to get a further qualification that would be the key to a lot of other stuff.
Right.
And also, you know, it made me contact. It definitely was what got me the job with the OU, was the fact that I was in the finishing stages of that, because it was sort of academically respectable, even though I couldn't wave a, you know, PGC or, you know, years in school or anything. And that sort of thing. So it was, and I did know, and I did love it, and it's up the road, and I got to go to things. and writing a novel is jolly lonely stuff, and it was quite nice to think, well, I've been working my backside off doing this, but at least I'm whizzing up to Goldsmiths because, you know, they've got Julian Barnes coming, or whoever it was, you know, and that sort of thing. So and I met people like Linda and so on. So it was the key to a lot of things, in a way. But it was hard work.
I can imagine.
Do you miss it now, Emma? Do you still have a strong connection with Goldsmith?
Well, I didn't. Well, actually, I mean, I didn't, in the sense that I, you know, once I stopped going there. They have asked me back to sort of talk to their, because they've got a big, busy MA there. And I've gone back and talked to them a couple of times, just to sort of one-off, you know, and so on. But in fact, I've just... been appointed to the Royal Literary Fund Fellowship?
Yeah.
And I've got one of those at Goldsmiths next year, which is lovely.
Great.
Really looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going back, though oddly sort of not belonging to the English department, as it were, which will different place and office. Mm-hmm. And I think the RNF fellows are quite separate, but I will still be there. So that'll be nice. I'll know my way around.
Definitely. Yes. Good. Catherine, did you want to add anything or ask anything?
I actually wanted to ask about the five under the bed, as to whether you sort of
you ever hanker after them, or whether you think it's better to just they're actually too much of their own thing for you to go back now and do anything with them?
I think the latter. I mean, to be honest, I have trouble remembering even what they are. But I think I'm not one for going back to old writing almost ever. But if you look at my current stuff, you know, the literary biographers in 200 years' time, who, of course, will be fascinated by me, I don't think. But anyway, you will certainly see traces of almost all of them in the current thing. I revisit themes a lot and ideas and places and things like that. So in a way, I mean, Secret Alchemy has elements of every single novel of its predecessors in it, apart from Mathematics of Love. It was my second go at Elizabeth Woodville, who was the mother of the Princess in the Tower. She had a whole novel to herself, the one before Mathematics of Love. The main character in the modern strand was someone who I'd tried before, whose particular situation I'd tried before, and so on. So on the one hand, I never go back to old texts, and I never go back to explicit old projects, but I do. It's like characters that go away. I have characters who won't go away, and I also have kind of ideas and themes who won't go away. No, I don't regret them not being under the bed. You know, I don't feel any urge to revisit them. I think it also always worries me when I hear of people going back and sort of taking something out from under the bed and blowing the dust off it and then starting to rework it. Because mostly it's because in their place, I would find it difficult not to try and sort of patch things together and sort it out. And I think you almost always get a better result if you start a project from zero and write it all the way through. I'm doing kind of bridge-like gestures with my hands. You can't see. But, you know, that I think there is a, on the one hand, to students, one is always saying, you know, revise, 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 work it again, have another go. You know, it's never wasted. But actually, I do think that once you're reasonably experienced, there is a sort of coherence to a project that you only really get by working it all, you know, being sunk in it from zero, starting it all fresh, if you like. I remember once when I was having my kitchen redone, and I had this idea that I wanted just bare sanded floorboards, and the builder coming up and saying, well, the trouble is this has always been a kitchen. The floor has been had up and chopped about so often that there's barely a whole plank in the whole room. You know, and I could, technically he could make a jigsaw out of everything. There were enough pieces of wood for the floor, but it was never going to look any good. And that actually it would be cheaper for me to give him 200 quid for him to go and buy a floor's worth of floorboards from the builder's merchants and do a new one. And he was absolutely right. And I think for me the temptation with going back to old stuff is because, you know, I'm sure some of the writing is probably fine and some of it's quite good and some of it probably isn't, lots of it probably isn't. And the temptation will be to try and hang on to that and stitch it together, and that never works as well as the writing coming along from that blank soupy place in your head that Tremaine talks about, you know, and it all coming, everything you write being for this project now. Does that make any sense at all?
Yes, it does. In the on the kitchen floor, I said to my builders, take it up, because it's too, this was in Edinburgh where everything said nonsense. By the time I've actually, you know, nailed it all again, there's some modern planks where it's been taken up, but I'll put those under the unit, so it'll look splendid when I polished it. But it does make sense, because on the one hand you're saying, actually, yes, it is, because it's the story of Elizabeth Woodville.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's different, because obviously if you've made the character up completely...
Well, you'd think so, but I do know people who sort of go back to something and they sort of take this bit out and sort of try and patch it together. And I don't know, especially if it's been a long time since you did it, you will be a different writer. Mm. You know, if you're not a different writer after 7 years of having written three other things, you blooming well ought to be. I mean, I'm sure there are novels out there that have been handled like that and you know, great for that writer, clever old men, they're cleverer than me. But I think it's very high risk that you will end up trying to sort of distort the old writing by trying to fit it into a new idea it doesn't really fit in, or distorting the new idea in order to accommodate the nice bits of old writing, if that makes any sense. Whereas if you pushed it all away and trusted that your writing is as good, you know, it's as good now as it was, it will do as good a job now as you did then, but it will do it much more coherently. The voice all the way through the novel I'll tell you a good example of that is my first ever novel, I wrote on a computer in the days when you couldn't fit a whole novel on a hard disk, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And so I had to keep it all on floppies and then move the file for the chapter I was working on across. And then when it was all high, well, then move it back and so on and so on. And so there was a lot of housekeeping involved. And one day, I was about a third of the way into the novel, one day I got my housekeeping wrong, and so I deleted all the new chapters off the hard drive when they weren't on the floppy. So I lost the middle third of the novel. And in fact, getting it back up to speed was such a huge job that I was doing other things, and I did a photography A-level in the middle of it and stuff. And when I went back to it, I did rewrite it, and I carried on and I finished the novel, but that novel was broken back at the point where I'd had to start rewriting forever. I never cured it, because basically I was a different sort of writer and my approach to stuff was different and so on, and I never cured it, and now I don't regret that. That took me 5 years to write that novel, and I think it wasn't time wasted at all, but I think that's the sort of thing that you risk happening. Is that you know, darning in the joins is not the same as having woven the whole thing in one in the first place.
That makes sense.
Thank you so much, Emma.
You're welcome.
It's really, really fascinating. We covered such a lot of ground there, and I shall remember that kitchen floor metaphor whenever I'm tempted.
Well, it is very tempting. It is tempting, and one does. Did write good stuff, you know. It's heartbreaking sometimes to think that it's just not going anywhere except staying under the bed, but you have to, I think.
Just pull them out and enjoy them for what they are.
Maybe, yes, or I sometimes say, well, that's lots of lovely work for the PhD people of the future.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And thank you for lovely questions as well. It's great to be asked. Really good thing.
Good. And I will send you the link to the MP3 as
That'd
well.
Be great.
So you've got a copy for yourself, and I will let you know when it's up on the club site, but also beyond that as well.
That's marvellous. And thank you, and Catherine, Rain, and Louise, thank you too. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And see you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you, Emma.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.